Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. It is the Coach Ben Rosario Show, and I am Coach Ben Rosario. And today our episode is going to be me speaking with a good friend of mine, Terry Shea. Terry is a very unheralded but very, very good coach, especially in the marathon. He coached Esther Erb to the USA Marathon Championship this past fall at Twin Cities. He's an accomplished marathoner himself, having run 2:20 in the marathon and qualified for both the 04 and 08 trials. He was a teammate of mine at the Hanson's Brooks team, or on the Hanson's Brooks team, back in the early to mid-2000s. We ran at the 04 trials together on that team and ran with Brian Sell and some of the big stars that you maybe recognize from the old Hanson's days. So Terry and I are going to talk about those days. We're also going to talk about marathon training and just coaching in general and just what he's been up to. He lives in Pennsylvania now with his family. And so I'm looking forward to this one. I think it's going to be a blast, and it'll give you guys maybe a good little insight into the old Hanson's days. Terry and I are pretty far removed from the program at this point, but I don't think it's that much different, and we can kind of tell you a little bit about how that program worked from an insider's perspective and maybe tell a couple old stories. But for sure, we'll talk training, and we'll talk about marathon training in particular. So here we go, Terry Shea. Hello. Terry, what's going on? What's going on, man?
All right, we're connected. Excellent. All right, excellent. Not much. Excited to chat with you. I feel like it's been too long.
Way too long, man. Way too long. Yeah, I figure we'll just have a nice, normal conversation, but we'll just record it, you know?
Okay. All right.
First of all, how's your running going?
Well, my running, let's see, ever since having Conrad, our little guy, who's now 2.5, and especially since having our girl Emmy about 6 months now, my running has been very up and down. I do try to get out there each day if I can, stay in some sort of consistent routine, but it's usually the first thing to go of the main priorities in my life. But at the moment, it's going pretty well. I've had 80-mile weeks since the start of the year, so hopefully I can keep that up.
Are you going to run a marathon this spring?
I do not plan to. I've been asked a few times running with people the past week or two. When they hear that I'm running 80 miles, they think it is a lot. But I'm just not ready to commit to any marathon and then have the pressure of doing the weekly or at least every 2 week long runs. I need my Sunday to be hopefully free to do a long run, but if it turns out I can't fit it in and have to scrap it, that's easier to do whenever there's not a marathon on the calendar looming.
Yeah, for sure. I cannot even possibly imagine when the last time I ran 80 miles in a week was. So you got me beat by quite a bit. Yeah, you know, I wanted to do this, man. I know you don't like to talk about your own coaching and all that kind of stuff, but I think you do a great job, and I think people would be wise to listen to some of the things you have to say. But and we'll get to that. But I also thought it would be cool to kind of talk about our background a little bit. You know, I think we're sort of lucky to have been on the Hanson's team when we were, because to me, I mean, don't you think? I mean, to me, those were the best years because it was all just getting started. It was so new. We had such a kind of an underdog, like ragtag feel about the bunch. You know, literally when I got there in 2003 in the summer, that's when the Brooks deal got signed. So when I went there, we didn't even have the Brooks deal. That was all happening that summer. I remember getting prototypes of shoes from other brands and things like that. And I think I still have somewhere in my deep in the recesses of my closet, I still think I have maybe the first ever Hanson's jersey. So it was just a Hanson's Brooks jersey, I should say. So it's just, it was a cool time to be there. And, you know, maybe we could talk about, you know, 04 and the trials and all that sort of thing. So, you know, first of all, tell everybody kind of how you got involved in the program.
Sure, sure. Well, I definitely feel like we were lucky in terms of if I were a, you know, a 221 marathoner these days, you know, they're not getting into the program. But circumstances around that time worked out that I was able to join, and I'm really fortunate to have had that chance and grateful to Keith and Kevin. So how I ended up there, my now wife, Carly, we were dating, living in the Boston area, not together, but she was becoming increasingly serious about her running, as was I, but she was really starting to look at some potential groups, and there weren't many. You know, she looked at the FILA Discover USA program. I think the Monterey Bay, Team Monterey was starting up. So she was sending out some inquiries, and she was lucky enough to get an invite to check out the Hanson's Brooks group, which again was just becoming Hanson's Brooks because they were pretty much just starting the women's team right then in 2003.
Yep.
She had a great trip and decided to make the move, and so she went out there in the fall of 2003. So initially we were planning to date long distance, which I wasn't keen on, but that's sort of just how it was, and I really was excited for her to have this opportunity. And we're just going to make it work. Well, that fall, I had a big breakthrough for me, at least, in dropping my own marathon time down from 227 to just under 222 in the race that we spent a lot of time together,
even though
we didn't know each other so well. But by qualifying for the 2004 Olympic trials, I think I just sort of eked in terms of what they would take in terms of another guy in the program. Of course, I think it helped that there were, you know, the connection with Carly having just or just planning to join them. And so I then made this decision once it was understood that I could get a spot on the team. So I decided to pack my bags as well and move from Boston out to Michigan and join the crew. That was right around, it was literally New Year's Day, I think, 2004, that I made the trip. And so arrived there just about 6 weeks before the trials.
Yeah, you kind of got thrown into the fire. But it was a good mix, though, because, you know, at that time, you know, as you mentioned or alluded to, I mean, the group was very good, and we certainly had very high-end people, but we also had people like myself and others that were more in that, like, just barely qualified kind of range. And
yep,
so
yep. Mm-hmm.
You kind of had a nice group. In fact, you know, people don't really know this inside story, but, you know, the way it kind of was in those weeks leading up to the trials, there was kind of our, like, top group, which was Brian Sell,
mm-hmm.
Clint Varon, Nick Cortez. God, was there anybody else in that group that I'm missing? I feel like that was the top group.
Yeah,
and
well,
then,
you know, Jeff Campbell maybe, but then I think he may have got hurt, and then I think he was made a decision to take off. But I thought at the start Jeff Campbell was in
That's right.
Group.
Jeff Campbell was in that group as well, but he decided that he wasn't ready, and so he ran U.S. Cross instead. That's what it was. But those were our top guys. And then there was a big group with you and I and Bob Buscord and several guys. But that group, our group, included Trent Briney because he was in the group that had just barely qualified. And, mm-hmm. You know, he was not considered one of our top guys really at all. And then he started hitting all the workouts with such ease, even when it was, you know, 5 degrees outside. And then we went to Houston. Remember that? And then we went to Houston,
mm-hmm.
and we were supposed to run marathon pace for the Houston half marathon 3 weeks before the trials. And he asked Keith and Kevin if he could go like 105 or 106 instead of 108 or 109 like we were going. And they said, okay. And sure enough, he hits it, no problem, laughing the whole time like it was no big deal, just being Trent. And then they threw him into Sell's group really 3 weeks out from the race.
And then he goes out every other workout, I think. Yeah.
That's right. It was crazy. Yeah. I mean, just talk about mm-hmm. what you remember from that.
Yeah. Well, it is funny that doesn't get brought up too often in terms of the training that Trent did for that. Well, perhaps people aren't privy to it. They just sort of see the result. But it was obvious to us, you know, training right alongside him and then seeing the eventual result, you know, how it all unfolded. But that right there it's always stuck with me as an example of the potential benefits of undertraining versus overtraining, because Trent was, you know, we would find out on the day of the trials, he was in fact undertraining, at least relative to some guys. He was on quite an upswing, of course, too. That was amazing. What he did there. Unbelievable. Of course.
Yeah,
I
remember. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, we also lived with him. The three of us were living together. And then
that's right.
Even once we got to Birmingham about 12 days or so before, we got to see Trent in action each day and sort of see the perfect storm, on its way to what happened with his performance there in the trials. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, it was fun. And that's right. Being on the upswing is huge. You know, I think that was a big time lesson from that segment for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I still think of to this day as well. I remember during the race, you know, I'm sure it was the same way for you. You ended up a little ahead of me, I think, right? Did I beat you or did you beat me there? I don't even remember.
I'm pretty sure you – I think you got me, I think. I think I was in the around 43rd or so. Yeah.
I think I was in the 30s. Yeah, I think I was in the 30s. But regardless, I remember that I had friends there, and toward the last loop, because it was those five-mile loops once you got into downtown Birmingham, I remember asking – someone like, you know, how's Sel doing? Because they had told me
mm-hmm.
that he was in the lead, you know, earlier. And you know, he was the guy we thought would make the team. And I remember them saying, I remember my friend saying, he drops back, but Trent's in fourth. And I was just like, I spent the next mile like thinking, surely he misspoke, you know, like maybe he meant Clint, you know, or something.
Yeah,
But no, sure enough, he was fourth and ran 2:12 and it was a cool day, but those were fun times because, man, we were just banging out stuff that, I don't know, it was kind of like, you know, those days were also, they also taught me something else, and they also taught me that you're capable of more than you think you are. Would you agree with that?
Yep. Yes, I definitely think so, and I think sometimes our mental toughness was challenged as well, like, what are you willing to do? They had us go out there in the winter, really cold day, and do a workout that was on paper. And, you know, we got out to Stony. It was dark, really cold. And it was like, well, it's on the schedule. We're doing it, you know. And so good. Now, you know, we could always debate, you know, should the workout have been pushed off a few days when there was less snow, this or that, adjust the paces. But I think it was a good lesson in that the athlete should always be ready to do whatever it takes. There's going to be some times where maybe adjustments are necessary. Other times I think, you know, you just got to push through and do it.
Oh yeah, for sure. I remember getting an email from Kevin after one that didn't go well and he was not pleased.
Yeah,
something to the effect of the weather doesn't stop us or whatever, and then we hit the next one. So it was kind of message received. But yeah, no, that's and honestly, you know, what's cool about that program is the mindset really hasn't changed all that much. You know, even though they are mm-hmm. much higher profile now, and Brian, of course, ended up going to the Olympics the next cycle, and then Desi went. And they've had all this great success, and they're very obviously they're a huge brand in the running industry. But I still think from what I know from talking to Luke and Keith and Kevin and just Lyndon and or you know Desi's husband and the people that are still there, I still think it's kind of the same mindset, and I think that's good.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Very cool. So that was something I wanted to get to just because it's just a little inside info into that program that I know mm-hmm. people like. But then you left after I guess 1 year, right?
Yeah, I can't believe Well, first off, I can't believe that was over 10 years ago, but I also can't believe that it was only 1 year that I was there.
I know. It seems like so long because you spend so much time with those people every single day.
Yeah, it's a lot like freshman year of college where, you know, you're with the team so much, like, you know, every, maybe not literally every meal like in college perhaps, but you see, you know, these guys who many become very close friends very soon, you know, and so you just pack so much into there that, you know, I look back, it's amazing, especially, you know, how, you know, you can become so close with some friends, you know, so quickly. It was just an absolutely amazing year, amazing experience. Yep. But yes, it was, I left after a year. It was, you know, about midway through that year, you know, I had to think about, you know, where I was in my life, the benefits I was getting from the running itself, the focus on running, but also what I, you know, was potentially giving up in terms of career. And I made the choice, it was a tough choice, but I think it was the right one for me at the time, and absolutely feel that way now, to head back to Boston at the end of the year in early 2005 to pick back up
And it wasn't too long after that that you started coaching people, right? At least, you know, informally and then formally, mm-hmm. as a coach on the BAA, right? How, what was that timeline like?
Sure. Yeah. So whenever I moved back to Boston in early 2005, but by then I was really comfortable in terms of having sort of amassed the knowledge that I felt I needed to coach myself, especially with a really valuable 1 year experience there. You know, combined with, you know, the reading of the literature in the years prior. And so, you know, I was coaching myself, and sort of by consequence of that, sort of coming up with my own training plan, but then also being very much aware of the importance of the social aspect of it in terms of, you know, wanting to get the guys together to train, you know, be it other guys in my club or even other clubs in the area. You know, it sort of led to some other guys sort of hopping on my training schedule, but me also thinking about, you know, these people as individuals and just sort of casually, you know, advising, giving input into, you know, basically friends training. And that's how it was for a few years. I would say when Carly moved back from Michigan herself 1 year later, started to more formally coach her. But I wasn't sort of a coach in title until very late 2008.
Okay.
What happened then was, in 2008, the BAA hosted the Women's Marathon Trials, absolutely awesome event. And the coach for the Boston Athletic Association, the women's coach, Jeff Staub, that was his sort of, you know, career highlight as a coach. Basically, it was his way of going out, you know, in style. He had been coaching the club for a long time, but he was preparing to step down, you know, I think because, you know, he had a lot going on in his life, work, family, etc. So he chose that time to step down. And so in the summer, there was basically an opening for the women's coach. And for, you know, a number of weeks or even months were passing by where the women didn't have a coach. And it, you know, definitely prompted me to think, okay, is this something that might be a good fit for me? Could I be a good fit for the role? And I ended up putting together a resume, submitting it, and a little later that year was selected as Jeff's replacement and started coaching with the BAA.
Very cool, very cool. And you know, during those years, again, you know, you kind of like to stay under the radar and those kind of things, but, I mean, I feel like there was a lot of really good performances from some of the women you were working with. Can you maybe give us a couple of the highlights?
Sure. Do you mean the time I was with the BAA or just since?
Yeah,
then,
the time you were
coaching
with the BAA and just some of the women you worked with and what they did.
Sure. Yeah, so some of the highlights. Well, first I'm going to start off with one that it's not marathon topic, but it's something that was really, I think, a really cool experience for the women's team, because we were usually focused on the marathon. A few years ago, a bunch of the women decided to have a mini indoor track season. And so, and these were marathoners, either a few that were training for the upcoming Boston, or a few that had run, you know, fall marathons and their next one wasn't for a little while. You know, Jeanette Faber, Emily Crocius, Brett Ely, Katie Hatch and Jen Campbell were training for were training for Boston, hoping to qualify. And then, oh, Diana Bowser was sort of coming back after having a few kids and hoping to qualify through the half marathon in a few months because she didn't want to do a marathon. But anyway, yeah. A collection of women who were all training together every Wednesday night decided to get on the track, you know, for January and February. And we had a really good BU Valentine's meet where all six, you know, went, I think, 16:50 or faster. I think four out of six of them ran PRs. It was just a really neat experience to see the women perform very well in what wasn't their, you know, their typical venue. At the time, you know, there's many clubs in New England, especially in the Boston area, and you know, I'd sometimes hear or read, oh, the BA, well, they're just marathoners. They don't do the track. So it was pretty cool to see, you know, in one heat, the women perform really well. Yeah,
that's cool. It also shows you, too, that, you know, and this ties into marathon training talk, is that there's no rule that says you lose all your speed when you do marathon training. You know, those, in fact, you know, that being an example, and there's several others, you actually can sometimes get faster on the track. Dathan Ritzenheim being an example, and there's plenty of others, because you get a base of strength that you've never had before, and if you can convert that strength into speed on the track, you can run, you know, things that you never thought you could run. I did the same thing actually. That's a good little piece or a good little nugget of information as well.
Yeah, so some other highlights at the BA, you know, thinking about marathons, you know, a few years winning the women's team title at the Boston Marathon, Brett Ely running, you know, some sub-240s, one which got her on the Pan Am Games team. That was a real highlight for us. And then Jeanette Faber had a number of really great performances as a BA athlete. She stuck with the BA even after moving out of Boston, and in one of her last races as a BA runner, won the Twin Cities Marathon in 2012. That was one of my all-time highlights, you know, being a part of that. I wasn't there, unfortunately, but extremely excited the entire day when she ran 2:32. With a 4-minute PR, keeping her PR streak, you know, alive. I think it was her 13th consecutive PR since
Party
marathons. And then she waited it out, you know, the next 6 months or so to see where her 2:32 would end up on a time list. And she was fortunate to join Dot McMahon and Dina on the U.S. team for the U.S. Championships in Moscow for the marathon. So that
World Championships, for sure.
World Championships, sorry. Yeah. So that was a big highlight as well.
Yeah, very cool. And, you know, with all the success and all the marathon success, you know, there's a few things I want to get at. So, because I want to just, you know, just talk a little training essentially. So, I feel like you and I, well, first of all, our backgrounds are so similar, you know, because we both ran at Hanson's, then we both went back home essentially and, you know, kind of coached ourselves, but kind of coached all our buddies who were just running with us kind of thing. And, you know, you just kind of develop a philosophy over time, and it's formed, and it's just like any coach, it's formed by your experiences, but it's also formed by, you know, again, and you mentioned it, the reading you've done and the studying you've done on different literature, and just in this day and age, just watching interviews, watching videos, pouring over results and just seeing who's doing things right and taking little bits here and there. And then eventually, you know, it kind of morphs into your own philosophy. And it's just kind of a blend of all these things. So now as we stand here or sit here in, 2015, kind of who have those biggest influences been on you coaching wise? And then, you know, if you could, how would you kind of define your own marathon training philosophy now?
Okay. Well, okay. Lots of tough questions there. Let me just digest all that for a second. As far as influences in with my coaching, there's sort of two spheres. I would say early on, you know, in terms of just educating myself, you know, so I could become faster, and then, you know, later applying that to coaching others, there's sort of like the fundamentals and principles and where do they come from. I would say more recently what I focus on is the individual, the person itself. So to any extent that I could, that I have or could at least describe a marathon philosophy, you know, there's two things. There's know the event, and by know the event, like what it takes to succeed at, you know, running 26.2 miles as fast as you can. All the basics, but also the little things that add up to big things. Course, shoes, when am I going to take, you know, my fuel, et cetera. There's knowing the event. Then it, because I've now coached a lot of different people with very different sort of life circumstances, in school, not in school, multiple jobs, or maybe one extremely demanding job. It's been really important to really get to know the person that I'm coaching. What is their day-to-day life like? And even if there is an ideal training plan for a person in general, does it make sense for this person specifically? I feel like a lot of the work I've done in the past few years is focusing on that area, with each individual, because everyone's very different in what one can handle and what makes sense. One might be able to handle a certain amount of work, but does it make sense for their situation? Those are the sort of the two areas. So I have influences, I guess, coming from either way. You know, from the event itself, I have, like you use the word blend. It's absolutely a blend. You know, I read things over time, picked and choose things that I thought made sense, that I was convinced were right. And I have applied those and continue to apply those. And ultimately, I think the most important thing is from the perspective of the marathon is doing the things that may not make a pace feel easy for someone, but making that pace be manageable, be sustainable late in the race. So many times people have said, oh, but it felt so easy for 20 miles or it felt so easy for 22. But we both know that really doesn't matter because of what happens in the last 2 or 4 or 6 miles. So I tend to focus on things that are going to get a person to be able to sustain a pace the entire race. As far as, were you looking for specific influences?
Let me throw this at you first. So
sure. In
terms of, you know, one of my biggest influences and certainly yours, and going back to the beginning of the conversation, you know, one of the things I like about, again, I'm trying to look at people that are doing it and doing it with success. And obviously we're fortunate to have run for the Hansons. But one thing that Keith and Kevin do with their group that I think for some reason, and I don't know why, people don't copy, and they should, is that they just pile on workout after workout after workout during a marathon segment. I mean, they have other segments, obviously. But of very, you know, what I would call marathon-specific work, and they're doing it all on pavement. They're getting the body calloused to handle the marathon, kind of like you, what you were saying. And they do 3x3 miles and 2x6 miles and a 26.2K, you know, marathon simulation run, and they do 5x2 miles and 6x1.5. I mean, it's just constant. It's a constant feeding of, you know, very long, very not particularly fast, as you say, either marathon pace or just maybe 10 seconds. They do a lot of stuff at 10 seconds faster than marathon pace, and they do it for a long time, and they do it on pavement. And I feel like that is certainly what I've taken from them, is that you have to have a good amount of that work in your legs. You can't just basically train like you used to train for the 10K, make your long run harder, and then maybe do a couple of marathon pace runs. That's not enough. That's a big, important thing to me. I think you're on the same page, but just talk about that from your end.
Yeah, absolutely. I've applied a lot of the type of work that we did out there. Number one, you have to make sure if someone's training for a marathon, they can't be afraid to do a workout on tired legs. And, you know, that's something that is one of the key things, you know, that they do espouse, and we just know is true. Like, okay, we ran 20 miles yesterday, maybe, you know, via 14 and 6 or something, or maybe we did a single 60-mile run. We might not feel good today with our workout, but, you know, the training is such that you're going to be able to do this workout. You might not feel great doing it, but you're going to be strong enough to hit every mile as they are planned. And as it turns out, once you get used to that kind of training, the first few miles can be frustrating because, okay, I am tired. I wish I felt better. These things going through your head. But then halfway through the workout, all right, things aren't much worse, and I'm halfway through. And then two-thirds of the way through the workout, you're just able to keep it going even if you never feel great. And there's many workouts like that. And then ultimately, you know, on race day, you take away some or most of that fatigue, and hopefully your legs feel a little bit different. And you have the strength, but you also have the fresh legs. And I do have a different sort of taper philosophy. Well, actually, I should say the taper philosophy is if someone finds something that works, I would rather that person go with that over what I might suggest. If they're open to, you know, a taper, then I do, you know, have one to suggest that they try out. But, you know, the taper can be tricky, but I do rest athletes a bit more than the Hanson's Brooks athletes do.
I agree with that. I do that as well. I do that as well. Although I think probably their things have changed too, you know, over the years. You know, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I know that they based a lot of things early on off of Brian, and he's an outlier, you know, as we all know. So I think that's always a danger for any coach. And again, I'm pretty sure just from talking to people that they do things a little bit differently now. But it's always a danger to have one good guy or one good girl, and they have success, and then you just do everything that you did with them. You know, like you say, everybody's an individual, and not everybody responds the same. I'll say this, and I learned this from – I actually use you as an example a lot of times, because you remember that year where you ran Boston, and you had some kind of little niggle. I can't remember what it was, but you basically didn't run for 2 weeks before the race, and then you still went out and ran 2:24, which was in the neighborhood of what you wanted to do. It wasn't quite as fast, but pretty close. You remember that? I mean, what I'm saying is those last 2 weeks, they really don't matter. I mean, you can only do too much. So it's not that I'm suggesting a huge taper where you don't run at all for 2 weeks, but I'm just saying you can only screw it up, you know, and so don't overthink that taper. Just back off. You know, it's just common sense, like you said, back off a little bit, bring the volume down a little bit, and make sure you're fresh, and then give it a go. I don't think it has to be, quite as difficult as some people make it out to be. And Kellen, the girl I coach, or the woman I coach, who just ran 2:28, same thing. Like, you know, I have the week planned that I like the people to do the week of the race, but she had a little hip thing going on, and so she really didn't run a lot that week. She mostly just jogged 30 minutes every day, and we didn't do any kind of little workout. And actually, she skipped one of the days, and mostly she was just in the training room getting a lot of work done, and she was totally fine, you know? So, I don't know. That's kind of my philosophy on it, is that those last 2 weeks, you know, you're really just trying to get the athlete confident and feeling good and feeling fresh and ready to go. There's not a big secret to the actual, you know, work that you do.
Sure, sure. Well, the taper, I mean, I think most runners would agree is in some ways the hardest thing because it's just, it's so mentally frustrating. The days drag on.
Yep.
You're so used to, you know, the training that when it's taken away, it's foreign and it's a time when doubts start to creep in, you know, when you're just missing your routine. And so, honestly, it's been, I've had multiple times where stuff has come up, unfortunately, you know, feeling something, you know, you worry about, and it's forced me to cut back more. But whenever, and a lot of times it's led to great races. It's perhaps a little more force stress than you would be willing to take if everything were going great. But then also just if you're distracted on something else, you know, that you have to address, it kind of takes away your focus of the race. And it's in a weird way, just something else to think about and you know, occupy your time with rather than just the absence of training, you know?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. It's really tough those last 2 weeks. All right, well, let's go back to something else then. If we can agree that those types of workouts and a steady diet of those types of things are good and they're both a part of our philosophies, what about some of the new things that you've injected? I saw that workout that a competitor featured the other day. I really thought it was cool, and it's maybe we can get into those kind of workouts here in a second because I've started thinking that you know, I'd like to be a little bit more creative moving forward with some of the workouts. And basically it was 6x1K with a 600 float and then a kick at the end, so it's 10K worth of work. I liked it because, you know, the traditional repeat is, you know, let's say 10x800 with a 400 jog. And during the 400 jog, it's slow. You essentially turn your mind off. You get to relax. And really, that's not very much what the race is like at all. In the race,
right,
any race of any distance, you have to be kind of pretty much laser focused the whole time. So what I like about that float recovery is that the athlete still has to be focused, still has to be intent on hitting a pace. Granted, it's not a terribly difficult pace, but it's still harder than a slow jog. And, you know, I just thought it was a super cool workout. So maybe talk a little bit about that and have those type of workouts kind of creeped into what you do overall.
Yeah, they definitely have over the past few years. So, you know, Renato Canova has been, you know, an influence for many, and me included, and a lot of it just makes sense. You know, you pointed out whenever you have these intervals where you might be going way faster than race pace, but then you get a break, you know, the tendency is, okay, I can do this next interval because I know I have this rest, you know, but in a race, it's continuous. There's, you know, there's just one finish line. So it just makes sense to me, you know, for a number of reasons. It forces your intervals to be probably a little closer to race pace than significantly faster. So overall, it might approach race. It might make it more race specific. And a lot of times, I have the combination of the faster interval and the moderate recovery come out to averaging, you know, right around marathon pace. Whereas, you know, with the Hanson's Brooks intervals of the sort 3x3 miles or 3x4 miles, you know, with something long and slow, you know, that might be 5 minutes rest or 3 minutes of whatever you want to do, or even a full mile easy, in certain cases when I think the athlete is ready for it, replace that with, okay, you're going to do a mile at after you've done 3 miles at 5:48 pace, Jeanette, your rest is going to be a mile at 6:30 pace. You know, and then at the end, you know, you've run 15 straight miles. You never got a real legit quote unquote break. And you've just piled on, you know, to use your phrase, a lot of work, most of it very close to marathon pace. I use that both in marathon training and then outside of marathon training. I've become, you know, a big fan of doing 200s on and off, just continuous, you know, usually around 5K pace for the quicker one, and then the slower one might be just 10 seconds slower, you know, maybe 40 and 50 for a woman, you know, and averages out to 6 minute pace, you know, do that for 4 miles and you've got a lot of work at, you know, your 5K pace. And you've also in the end got in a way a tempo run, because it's averaging 6 minute pace. So, it's one of the ways in which I have some people do their speed workout where I want them to get a little more than just turnover. And then finally, I think a workout that like that is going to force someone to learn the very important notion of discipline, when it comes to pace. Because if they get carried away on any part of it, whenever your rest is that challenging, at that quick of a pace for a quote unquote rest interval, you know, the workout's going to go south and you only want to learn that once. So,
yeah, very good. Very good. No, it's cool. I think that exact same thing. And I've been doing a little bit of more of that, you know, kind of work naturally. And then I just read Steve Magnus's book and he has a lot of those type of workouts in there too. And it just kind of put me over the edge to say, okay, I really want to start incorporating more of this type of work. Like you say, you know, it makes sense, you know, and for me, it's always when I'm writing a schedule, it's always, you know, if I'm having trouble and trying to decide, I always try to step back and say, what makes the most sense, you know, mm-hmm. and those really do. So that's very interesting to hear. What about as you've gone through the years, what becomes, now I know they all, you know, add up to a cumulative amount of work, but as you're in that like 4 weeks out, 3 weeks out range, what are some of the go-tos that you're using, the big barometer kind of workouts?
Yeah, this hasn't changed much over the years, but I think probably the biggest thing for me is when to have the athlete run their final marathon pace long run.
Yep.
So, you know, it's something that I've generally used, I think, ever for over time is, you know, starting back around 8 weeks out or maybe 10 weeks out, doing, you know, the first long run, which incorporates probably goal marathon pace, but if that's not right for the situation, then at least current marathon effort. For some stretch built into a long run, not too early so that, you know, the legs are a little bit tired, you know, and something that might go anywhere from 5 to 8 miles. And then building that up over the course of like 3 or 4 long runs over time, building up the length of the marathon pace portion to something that might get anywhere from 12 miles on the high end to maybe even 16 miles on the high end, depending on the circumstances. And so that's a key, that one of the key workouts done in the last month. And a lot of times it's figuring out, should I do that? Should the individual do it at 15 days out or 20 days out or somewhere in that time frame? So figuring out when to do that is one of the key things, you know.
That's me too. That's me too. And it's always, you know, I've done it 4 weeks out, I've done it 3 weeks out, and I've done it 2 weeks out. And I think, I think I like three best, but I also don't think that it's the end of the world if it's 4 or 2, although if I had to choose, 2 would be my least favorite, but I've had to do it that quick. I've had to do it a couple times 2 weeks out just because of the nature of the particular segment where it was rushed and, you know, maybe we got a late start or there was an injury or something like that. But I think I like three. But again, I don't think, you know, if you're listening to this, I don't think it's a magic formula.
Sure, sure. Yeah. But, like, personally, I did before the Chicago 2003 marathon where, you know, where we ran together, I ended up having one that went better than planned, and it was kind of far out. It was about 4 weeks out, and it went really well, and which was good. I regained some confidence, which I had lost a week earlier at the New Haven 20K, but it also was like, okay, where do I go from here? I thought I was going to do something like this next week, but this went so well. And so I chose to not be greedy in the sense that I don't need to build on this. You know, I am in shape. What I want to do is make sure I don't do anything that puts me on the decline, you know, by getting too greedy. So the next week I did a challenging long run, but it was more just a long progression, you know, where I spent like maybe the last 5 miles of the long run at marathon pace, rather than feeling like I needed to go from 14 up to 16 or something like that. So that was a case where 4 weeks was right for me. Sometimes others, 3 weeks has been usually the default. But there's been some cases where 2 weeks has worked really well. For Eric Ashe and Brian Harvey this past year before the Twin Cities U.S. Champs in October, I think they went about 15 days out, and I think that was really good for where they were coming on a relatively shorter marathon specific build-up, because they sort of worked on 10K pace on the first, you know, 8 weeks in the late summer, or in the summer, you know, before switching over specifically to marathon pace. So, yeah, for me, it's, you know, one time I was scared to do it 2 weeks out, but I've seen it work. And yeah, so it's just a matter of what's appropriate for the athlete.
Now, here's a question. So this is just kind of in the course of conversation here. So one challenge that I've had is, you know, because that workout, and I'm trying to switch this, like, you know, in people's minds, but that workout where you go, let's say it's 16 at marathon pace, it starts like taking up too much, too big of a place in an athlete's mind, you know, and
yeah.
they sort
mm-hmm.
of see it as like the end of the segment, you know, and I wasn't liking
mm-hmm.
that. I wasn't liking that feeling like the end of the
yeah.
segment, especially when it's still 3 weeks out. So what
yeah.
I did with Kellen this past segment before Houston, and what I'm doing with Matt and Scott before LA is they've got that. And then their next workout is not terribly difficult because it, you know, you can't just, that's a very difficult workout, you know, so the next one is kind of
yep.
medium. And then they do the 2x6 and they do that 2 weeks out. And that's the 2x6
yep.
miler that the Hansons always did. And that seemed to work really well for Kellen. And I'm excited about that because that having that 2x6 looming, if you will, 2 weeks out, I don't know. I feel like it took a little bit of pressure off that 16. It didn't make it seem like the end of the segment. It made it seem like we were still building. And so that was a challenge for me. So I don't know if that's something that comes up with you too. Like, how do you keep the athlete feeling like they're moving forward when they hit this big workout?
Yeah. Well, that is right there one of the reasons where I start to like it being 2 weeks out, as long as, you know, physically it's not too much of a toll given what's left. That's why I started liking 2 weeks out a little more than three or four, because yeah, when they'd hit that, then it's like, okay, what do I do now? What do I,
yep.
you know? And it all of a sudden makes the time between that point and race day feel like an eternity. And yeah, you don't want to mess around, open it up and up opportunities for doubts to set in. So when you mentioned that about the 2x6, I think, for Carly's last marathon, I think that the 2 week out workout was a 2x6. I actually got to join her on that. My family was in town. This was for her last marathon. She did right before Emmy came, or before getting pregnant with Emmy, I should say. And that was a good one for her. You know, something challenging. It was a confidence
yeah.
boost. But it worked really well for the time. But managing the last several weeks in terms of it before the taper, you know, what to do there is a challenge, you know, the appropriately challenging workouts. Yeah.
So I'll let you go with one last conversation here. Now, I know you said you don't have time to, you know, keep track of everything like you used to, but let's just talk in general, with 1 year to go, almost to the day, 1 year to go, I think it was last week. What are you thinking about the 2016 trials? Obviously, you have people that you're coaching and that, you know, may be up there in the mix, as do I. And it's never too early to start thinking about how to best prepare the athletes. And so when I think about LA and it's going to be another criterium course, it'll be probably maybe a touch more rolling than Houston, just because it's tough to find flat areas in LA.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly much flatter and fairer than, or I don't know, fairer, but much flatter than the regular LA course. You know, last time we saw the guys race go 2:09 to make the team. I don't personally think it's going to be as fast next year, but as you sort of, you know, put on, put on the Nostradamus cap. What do you see out of the 2016 trials?
I thought you might want to talk predictions. I can't remember. I've gotten countless emails from you. You usually include Nick Cordes on them, asking for predictions before every race. And I think you probably go back to your inbox and find a lot of unanswered emails. You only get Nick to respond. Another good friend, Pat Callahan, is always trying to get predictions out of me. But I hate making marathon predictions. It's such a it's so many, you know, factors in terms of a marathon. I think it's so hard to predict. And honestly, these days, with so much going on, I do feel a bit removed from, you know, everything going on in the marathoning world, at least outside of the handful of people that I'm coaching. But, you know, you mentioned you think it might not be overall as fast as a race. I guess we'll have to see the course first, but I mean, Houston for the men and women, you know, it was a, you know, pretty big step up from past trials. Just as, you know, Boston and New York City in 2007-2008 was a big step up, you know, from Birmingham and St. Louis. The way that the marathon times just keep coming down, especially for the women. You know, I just think there's going to be, you know, a lot of depth, a lot of people running pretty fast. How fast might depend on the course, but I just, you know, thinking about the women, I don't see races. I don't see a race going like it did, you know, back when, you know, Magna went out on her own and people let her go. I'd say this time around, it would be more like Houston, where if someone goes, almost anyone, you know, goes, you know, the pack is going to have to go with it because, you know, there's just so many good people right now, at least on the women's side. So that's not much of a prediction, but I don't see anyone just running away from it in either the men's or women's race.
No, I agree 100%, especially in the women. I think the women's race is going to be fast, you know, because I don't think you know, without necessarily even talking about anybody specifically, it doesn't really behoove the favorites to have it be slow. You know, it behooves them to have it be fast and try to get rid of anybody that could possibly be a factor, you know? The guy side, I just see it as being different only because, you know, last time was such an outlier in terms of how fast it went out. And unless Ryan does that again, it just doesn't seem like there's another person that would try to do that. But, you know, I don't necessarily want my athletes to listen to this because, you know, you just never know what's going to happen. You got to be prepared for any sort of race. But I just think that the early miles, there'll be a certain amount of feeling out in that guy's race that would probably be enough. That feeling out period will probably be long enough that it would prevent a super fast time. But I think it's going to be fast. I just don't think it's going to be as fast, you know, as last time. And you talked about the depth and maybe just one more comment. You know, I think you're right. I think the women are just getting faster and faster and faster. But we still don't have the men going sub 210. Is there anything you think that you can think of that seems to be the reason for that?
Question. Because I, you know, I don't know the details of any given person's training outside of the people that I coach myself or maybe, you know, have available online, although it is hard to find the time to, you know, to read all the training that's out there, you know, like I used to be able to. But I would probably, if I had to speculate, it'd probably be two of the things that come up a lot. You know, are guys waiting too long? Some of the guys that could go under 210, are they just opting not to run the marathon? You know, so you probably have a bunch of people capable of that. Of those that, you know, are getting into it, is it something with the training? I think that overall I get the sense that people are training better when, you know, we were talking about some of the training becoming more specific to the event, and I think a lot of people are getting that now, things have improved, and it will keep going that way. There might also be the you know, the mental component, needing to see other people do it, and then relating to them in such a way that you say, well, if they did it, I can do it. That's a, you know, a big thing that happens. And so you might just need a few more guys to do it, to get other guys confident that, you know, that there's no reason they can't either. So, those are just some general thoughts, but I think it's a tough question for me to try to answer at this point.
No, I think that's a really good answer. You saw 36 people went under 4 minutes this weekend in the United States. So I think you can see that once a barrier gets broken and broken big time, it just doesn't become as big of a deal anymore. So I think that's about as good of an answer as I've heard. Okay, so anything coming up here soon? You got anybody running Boston?
Yes, a few individuals, not nearly as many as last year. Last year, I think I was coaching 8 that ran in Boston. But this year, just, I think, 2, I think. Yeah, 2 women running Boston. So not nearly as a big, or I'm sorry, 3 women running Boston. Not as big a year as it has in the past. Yeah.
And then a couple at L.A.?
One woman, Sarah Cummings, is running L.A. Yes, yes.
Okay.
So you'll get to see her next month. Yep. Yeah.
Very cool,
and,
cool.
People are all over the map at this point with various different things. Some people were doing grandmas in June, so that will be exciting to see. So.
Well, very good. Terry, man, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. It was good to catch up, and we'll have to stay in touch, man. Lots of fun stuff ahead.
Well, thanks a lot, Ben, and again, congratulations on the recent big news with Hoka One. So that's great.
Thanks, man. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
See ya.
See you, Ben.
All right, that was my good friend Terry Shea. He was worried that he would be boring, but I don't think he was boring at all. I think that was awesome. if you're a coach, certainly there was a ton to take from Terry's comments, and if you're an athlete as well, certainly marathon training and talking about the specificity of the marathon and how he's adapted his workouts over the years, and I really liked some of the things about the approach he's taking to the recovery intervals. It's the same approach I'm taking, and that's something that I'm going to be kind of changing this spring in particular with the Hoka One One NAZ Elite Athletes, and you can read about that on some of the blog posts I'll be putting out, including one I just put out today on the alternating pace long run that Matt Yano and Scott Smith just did. So follow us at www.nazelite.com. A big thanks to our sponsors, Hoka One One and Training Peaks. And a huge, huge thanks to Terry Shea for joining us today and giving us a ton of great insights on marathon training. He's a really good coach and a really good friend. So thanks a lot, everybody, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Coach Ben Rosario Show.